Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. On behalf of the trustees, director and staff, it's my great pleasure this evening to welcome you to this, the first Manx Museum of the 1990s. They called the last lot the naughty 90s. I don't know what in retrospect they will call these. The new 90s, shall we say. And to welcome home tonight our guest lecturer, Brian Neal. Born in Douglas in 1930, Mr. Neal is a true Manxman. His grandparents were steeped in the traditional lifestyle of the Manx countryside, and his father was at the very heart of the island community as editor of a long-established local newspaper, alas, no longer on the newsstands, the Mona's Herald. Mr. W.T. Neal also worked on behalf of the Manx Museum and National Trust for many years, originally being appointed as a trustee in 1952 as the Education Authority's representative and serving from 1957 until his death as chairman of the Executive Council of the Trust. It was a sad stroke of fate that he died months before the museum's major exhibition of his son's work held in March 1964. Both his parents came from old established Manx families. The Neals were from Laurel Bank at St. John's, and his mother, a Cooley, from Baldoon, where her family had farmed for generations. Both their sons were extremely talented, Brian as an artist, and his brother, Nigel, as a writer, who came to the attention of the Manx public firstly with that rather eerie book of short stories entitled Tomato Cane and Other Stories, no relation of mine, may I add. And then later, he made a tremendous impression on the British television viewing public with the series of Quatermass episodes, which were followed by feature-length films. But Mr. Brian Neal's Manx background has had a profound effect on his development as an artist. Perhaps partly as a result of childhood hearing difficulties, he pursued a solitary but accelerated course in the mastery of drawing techniques, and by the time he attended Douglas High School, painting had become his absorbing interest. He completed a number of portraits of his classmates, which revealed his growing accomplishment as a painter, which inevitably led him to spend a specialized year of study at the Douglas School of Art in 1947. From there, he was awarded a scholarship at the Royal Academy Schools in London, where within a year he had won the Rome Prize in painting, which enabled him to spend the next 2 years in Italy. There, his developing artistic talents were exposed not only to the traditions of the old masters, but also to the techniques of leading exponents of exciting and innovative modern artistic trends. During the 1950s, he exhibited paintings regularly in London, but returned for a time to the Isle of Man to try to evolve a more primitive and abstract style. Sculpture followed with a dramatic breakthrough in 1960 when he learned the art, and I use the term advisedly, of steel welding. And in 1964, he became tutor in the School of Sculpture of the Royal College of Art and is now head of the department. He has achieved international recognition both as painter and sculptor and has exhibited widely, becoming the first Manx Royal Academician. The island still affords an important influence, and he in turn has contributed to the development of artistic endeavours on the island, being a founder member of the Manx Art Council. We are proud to exhibit his work here in the National Art Collections of the island, and look forward this evening to hearing about his work, his life, and times. Mr. Brian Neal.
Well, thank you very much for that introduction. You seem to covered my beginnings very neatly. I think that growing up in the island, of course, was a very unique experience. And I think it has always been a tremendous source of ideas and inspiration in all sorts of ways. You know, I didn't ever go to England except once. It was followed soon afterwards by the beginning of war, and I used to think of England as being some sort of unimaginable, faraway place. But the really important things were, you know, spending summer on the farms at Fuldoon and Ballinas and Foxdale and Laurel Bank, staying at Miss Lacey's cottage at Pool Vash and down Mona's Herald office. All sorts of funny things you see there. I was thinking today, you know, coming back, all sorts of things come back into my mind, like things that actually cropped up in my mind later on, which have been when I've seen something some sculptor has done, quite often I think, well, I've seen that before. I've seen it here. I've seen it in the Isle of Man. I mean, for instance, I was thinking today when we were down the prom, I suddenly remembered an extraordinary sight. A friend of mine was at school with me. His mother was the housekeeper to a sort of very eccentric Manx millionaire by the name of Colby Coven. And Colby had an absolute obsession about boats. He used to buy up the old Manx packet boats. And his obsession was that one day he might want to go away. He might want to go to somewhere, to England, somewhere or other. And so steam was kept up on all these old packet boats, morning, noon, and night. But then the masterpiece was one in Douglas Harbour, which he decided to have painted. I've forgotten what the word is, but there was a way of painting so that things look as if they're made of wood. You probably know what I mean. Graining. He had the entire ship, 5,000-ton ship, grained. And it was a masterpiece. And of course, at the time, we thought, well, Colby is doing his. But had I a photograph of this thing now, it would probably be rank high in, you know, in the art galleries and things. The most famous non-wooden ship of all time, you know. And there are lots of things like that that struck me. I remember another thing. Things come back to me a lot. During the war, when I was at school, the only thing that our headmaster, Bill Sykes, ever really thought about was the National Savings Campaign. And because I was a bit deaf and he thought that I was rather good at that sort of thing, I spent most of my time painting National Savings posters, like Salute the Soldier, Wings for Victory, Invasion Today, you know, which is what I did. But my masterpiece was the creation of, which I still look back on with enormous pride, because it, in a way, is the sort of thing that tied up to the sculpture later on. I covered the entire main hall with hundreds and hundreds of beautifully cut out Messerschmitts. And every time one of these kids bought 5 quid's worth of National Savings, he got the Messerschmitt and we put a Spitfire up. So gradually, all the Messerschmitts became enveloped by a sea of Spitfires. What we discovered later was the wretches were actually cashing in their £5 worth after about a week, which you could do in those days, and coming back for another Spitfire. So you can't win them all. Anyway, perhaps I'd better start showing the slides. I'll just tell you a little bit about them, about the things that they cross out. This is one of my first paintings when I came back from Rome. It's quite an interesting story, actually. I'll tell you very, very quickly what happened. Was Lord Beaverbrook, who was the owner of the Daily Express, had never been known for having the slightest interest in the arts in any shape or form. And he, some reason or other, took on a man called LaRue Smith LaRue, who was an ex-assistant of the Tate. And he persuaded him to have his portrait painted by Graham Sutherland, who was, of course, a famous did some very, very famous paintings of Somerset Maugham, and a great painter. And LaRue persuaded him to hold a competition for young artists. And it was judged by Graham Sutherland, Herbert Reed, and Sir Anthony Blunt, who you may have heard of. Anyway, I won the first prize with that horse. So I owe a lot to Sir Anthony Blunt one way or another, because it was a great help in my future career. This was a slightly earlier painting, actually, which I did. Some of the early slides are black and white, and they crop up every now and then, because we really weren't very much into color ones in those days. This is one of the paintings I did with Hal in Town, a man rolling a cigarette, and sort of... I was always thought of paint as being something I constructed with at this time, and I think you'll see the sort of way I put paint together later on was, well, the way I worked in other materials. This painting is actually very big. It's as big as that slide. It now belongs to Brian Forbes, the writer and actor, and Nanette Newman, and they still have it, and it's rather dominating and not exactly a very cheering thing, but they've managed to live with it all these years. There's a big jump here. This is really what happened was that I've been painting for quite a number of years, and actually I got to the point where I was trying to push paint into sort of three dimensions. I painted a lot of portraits, for instance, very much in the style of the other ones you've seen, with people like Charles Laughton, Michael Redgrave, various other people, Richard Attenborough, people like that, a lot of actors. I got increasingly tormented by the idea that I actually wanted to not only copy or reconstruct the thing in front of me, but actually bring it actually out into the third dimension. And I came back to the island, and I stayed at Dr. Ferguson's cottage up at Bully Bain. And I drew and really went back to the beginning, as if I went right back to the first, back to the Salute the Soldiers days. And I took myself really apart and decided I would learn to draw and paint and see and think right over again. And when I went back to London, I began to make my first sculptures. And I found that metal was the material that most interested me. And I'd always liked the metalwork of people like Archie Knox and things I was very familiar with. I was always drawn towards the things which I knew, the plows, the farm implements, the bits of armor, things in the museum, because I always spent a lot of time here as growing up, looking at all these odds and ends, Viking remains and things like that. And so metal seemed to be a natural thing to make things of. And the idea of forging, the fire and the heat and the hammer, also is something I wanted to deal with. And of course, I soon learned that, of course, sculpture was very close to the art of the armorer. And I remember getting very excited by the armor in the Tower and in the Wallace collection, and really feeling that I was in tune with those same people. I too could make anything they could. This is a crucifix that I made at the time. It's a mixture of old battered pieces of oak, which I dug out of a cow shed, and steel iron forgings. It's a bit out of focus. Do you think you can bring it in a bit? That's it. And this is another very complicated forging, where it was based on the idea of a steel head, an anatomy. This is something that crops up again, I'll probably tell you about later on. And this is a huge armor figure forged out of steel plate. It took me about 6 months to make, actually. because I was working. I'd actually, interesting enough, I had actually found a forge in the middle of London. I'd been working in a variety of odd places because as a painter, it's very easy to find somewhere to work. You can work in a room and anywhere in a flat, but to forge metal with hammers and fire and smoke and all that sort of fantasy is quite difficult. But by complete accident, in the middle of the Fulham Road, not far from Knightsbridge, I was in a shop buying some bits and pieces, and I started talking to the man that sold me nails and screws, and I wanted a forge, and he said, "We've got one next door." He said, "It's been empty for years. Are you interested?" So I went in, there it was. 2 days later, I had the whole thing on the go, and I stayed there for 10 years. And it was a fantastic place, you know, just like a smithy you would find over here, with a leather bellows and anvils and all the rest of it. This is another piece I made at that time called the Iron Pig. And you see, one of the things about forging is that you handle a piece of metal and you hammer it, just as a man who was making a horseshoe or whatever, but it's living metal. It's, you know, you're forming it and shaping it in the same way as it's always been traditionally handled. And I liked the way the bits themselves achieved character. So, and I kept them separate. I riveted them together. And you'll see the rivet marks there. And again, that led on to other things. This is a much more ambitious piece later on, which is a much bigger piece, where I was getting much more confident of what I could do with metal. And I could swing it around and make all sorts of things out of it by this time. And this is when the real explosion in my work took place. This is another one at that time. It's called the Camberwell Beauty. It was made for Camberwell Borough Council. It revolves, it's a huge thing. It revolves in a building, but very, very slowly in a building not unlike this one, actually. It's within the Tate in the exhibition mid-60s. And I'm going to use these slides a lot now. What this is an exhibition I had 1986-87 in the Royal College of Art in their new Henry Moore Gallery. And because they wanted me to show, the Henry Moore Foundation asked me to have a retrospective of my work there. So in fact, it's you'll see all sorts of pieces here dating back to various periods. As you see, it's an ideal setting of the sculpture. There's a beautiful white gallery with marble floor and marvelous lighting. And here in front of us is one of the last big forged pieces I made at that time. This is quite an interesting thing, actually, because again, getting rather ambitious about using a forge. I was going to take on the thing, what is the next thing from, you push away from forging into a greater force. And one of my friends at that time was I knew Augustus John quite well. I'd known him when I was a student. And his son, Caspar John, was the first Sea Lord. And he used to come down to the pub and talk to us sculptors because he was brought up with artists. And he was a wonderful man. He was a great, I mean, he was in charge of the Navy, but he never lost his interest in his friends, the artists. And I told him one day that what I really wanted was to blow things up. I said, if I could only get down to get your chaps to give me a hand, we could really tear some metal to pieces and see what happened. So a few weeks later, I got a phone call saying, if I went down to the bomb disposal area at Lydd, I would meet some Portuguese matelots in a bomb disposal squad, and they'd do whatever I wanted. So I went down, and we blew up everything in sight, including, I'm ashamed to say, a First World War tank. But actually, I used some of the bits of metal from that. That metal there is about 3 or 4 inches thick, and it was blown straight out of the side of a some sort of bomb or something or other. I can't remember what it was now. I remember driving back to London with a lorry load of this terrible stuff, torn edges, squeaking and shrieking. Now, this is a pendulum piece. Again, I was getting more and more interested in the idea of a sculpture which would articulate like the bones in the body. The hinge, I suppose it came a bit out of the idea of the separate plates of the forged objects. So I made a number of pieces where I kept the elements separate. So this actually can move and balance, and it behaves as a really articulated object. This is a piece that belongs to Tate, and it's a rather simple piece, but you can see the quality of the metal, the feel of the thickness of the metal, the way the metal's been cut, and it has, obviously it's got a relationship to the joint, the knuckle, the knee, and all sorts of elements of the human body come into it. And though it's in fact a very formal object, a very thing of shapes and forms. And there actually is a part of this is called the Bible box. And it's a mixture of a soft shaped box which is actually pitted by explosives. It was actually a piece of metal which had been blown apart and then re-welded together, joined to partly machined, partly linked forms. It's a job to describe this, but you probably know yourself when you see something, possibly in a museum or in ordinary life, you don't quite know what its usage is. You're not quite sure what it's supposed to be for, but nevertheless, the form and shape of it seems to hold your attention, and it sticks with you. And I think there are instinctive reactions to shapes and forms. It may be about the things you played with as a child, or the things you dig the garden with, or whatever. That is a sort of way into sculpture. It's a way of feeling about shapes and forms. It's a knowledge of something outside yourself. And sculpture gets into everything. When you're buying your car or your kettle, you are in fact getting into the idea of looking at form. And what I tried to do here was to use the mystery of this sort of thinking. And I suppose when I called it the Bible box, I liked the idea of the box which had an extra meaning. You know, each sculpture has its own forms, its own raison d'etre. It makes its own demand. You start putting this together and that together, and after a bit, there seems to be an inevitability of one shape reacting against another to make the thing a living entity. This is actually one of my best, most important sculptures of that period. It was made in about 1964, and it was probably one of the most complicated pieces I had made at that time. The idea being, in fact, again, was a psychological thing, was to join shapes and forms which, mechanically, which had, in fact, very little to do with each other, so they formed a sort of a sort of language, a sort of persona, so that an image was born, so the thing itself had a quality of mystery, of interest. Like, for instance, the spinning of the spiral gives a source of energy, rather like the heart. That is a source of light, the mystery of this underneath, the space under the big cone. This sort of calling shape, the hand up here, and where it touches the ground makes its emphasis on how your feet go on the ground as you walk or stand. Now this one, again, uses the idea of hanging, of tension, and the blackberries are steel balls. And I call this piece the catalyst, because to me it's the beginning of a change of idea. It was, I found it a very exciting thing. It's still one of the pieces I like best. It's in the Walker Art Gallery now, or it's in the Tate of the North. It was in the Walker Gallery, maybe in the Tate of the North, I'm not sure. But it's two pieces really, the frame and the hanging shape and the balanced arm. And sometimes I try to draw that thing, and I find it so difficult to remember how I got it together. I just somehow or other made it right for me. Here's another general view of the show. And this is one of a pair of heavy dome-like sculptures, which have sort of affinities with, I suppose, submarines, turrets, protected. But they're very, very simple things, basically. You see the other one in a moment. They're very big. They're about mass as much as them. They're about simple but extremely strong, powerful shapes, like fortresses, like gun turrets. They have power. They're also the armored head. And here's one where I was using the ripped up metal from the explosion, because that was actually formed by the box-like thing, the head-like shape, was actually formed by partly exploding the metal. The curve came out of the force of the explosion. But that is called shadow, and it's a particularly important one for me, because I think it's one of the pieces where I managed to tie up the idea of the metal, the abstract form, with the living personality of an object which is created out of purely mechanical material. Here I took three, this is the corner. I made three corners. One was to hold this suspended shape with a sort of explosion of material coming out of it. It's metal, crumpled metal and brass, which hangs in this rather mysterious space. And the other one was, I don't know whether I've got the sequence right now, it will come up later. This is the biggest one I did about that time, because I'd been asked to put together a retrospective of all my work at Whitechapel Gallery in 1966. And the whole thing was rather hair-raising, actually, because, in fact, what happened was that the director of the Whitechapel had given me the impression that he wanted me to put on the show in 1967, in the autumn of 1967. So in mid-August 1966, he spoke to me and he said he was going to have to put the show off till January. And I said, that seems to be forever, you know, miles ahead. And he said, do you realize it's January 1966? I had 3 months, 4 months. So I had to produce something like, nearly all the sculptures you've seen, the latter ones, were done in that time. But this is the culmination of it. This is the big one. And it's called O and A. It's a huge piece. I made it over the Christmas of 1965-66, and it was so massive that my studio wasn't big enough to contain it. So what I did was, in fact, cut a hole in the roof, and so the top half of it went into the top part of the building. So I couldn't actually see the whole thing together at all, because it had to be lined up. But about halfway up, it sort of went through the ceiling and re-emerged in the rooms above. And I had a terrifying time with it. The main column weighs nearly a ton, And I'd asked the people at Whitechapel to give me the height of the gallery. And they said it was 26 feet high. So I made this 24 feet high. We got into the gallery, and there was only one place you could sling a pulley through, right in the middle. So we slung it through, and halfway up, I realized they'd measured wrong, and it wouldn't go up. In fact, they'd measured one corner of the gallery. Well, there was no chance whatsoever of getting any form of gantry or pulley or anything like that. But I did have an awful lot of men. So off we did. We had no chance, no tackle. I had to get the thing up. And anybody who knows about putting exhibitions up, I'm sure you appreciate here in the museum, is you can't hang about. So what we did was I formed a human ram, and we pushed it up. There was a poor little chap chewing a box at the bottom, and the rest clambered on top of him, and we all shoved. And about halfway up, they all began to laugh. And I realized the thing was going to come down on top of them and would certainly have killed them, or at least some of them. So I started screaming and shouting and calling them everything under the sun. And they got so angry, they suddenly gave a heave, and up she went. And then we were able to move it around. But I still have bad nerves about what would have happened if it had fallen back. So there's the other box there. That's the other corner. Each of the corners had a different character. And this is the simplest one. Each of them retained a different sort of mystery in there. Now, because when you've had a big exhibition, you tend, in fact, to come to the end of a whole chain of ideas. It's like, you know, part of your life has changed forever. You look back and you feel all the things you've done, and you wonder what are the next step. And I realized at the time, I had an absolute feeling that what I wanted to do more than anything else was to understand the use of mechanics and machines. I wanted to be able to tackle the whole idea of the mechanical sculpture. I wanted a much clearer, purer, a more finite, a more planned way. I removed the romanticism from my work completely. And this huge piece of sculpture emerged. Oh, there's got one in the middle. But I'll go back, actually. In fact, I got the wrong sequence. Because the first thing that happened, actually, was, it was quite interesting that this is another Manx connection. I'd been asked to produce a very big commission in London about 2 or 3 years before that. And I was over here, and I hadn't really decided what to do at all. But all I knew was I would like to make it out of materials I was familiar with, like the forged steel and something else. And I was driving down to the airport, and I was looking at the stone hedges on the way. And I just stopped off, and I picked up a couple of pieces of slate from some hedge or other on South Peru. And I put them in my luggage, carried them on the plane. And when I got to London, I made this piece of sculpture, which was made of two pieces of slate and steel. And eventually, that emerged as a very big piece I made for Lambeth Borough Council, using really massive lumps of steel, of slate, and huge pieces of steel. And I took up the idea directly after the Whitechapel show was over, because I had several assistants, and we'd all rather come to the end of, you know, a terrifying period of intense hard work, just stopped like that. So I was, an architect friend of mine said, would I build a wall for him in Jermyn Street? So I did, and I used slate and steel, and it was up there for 40 years. So it stood the test of time, and I've always rather liked it, actually. But it's a wonderful, these natural materials like slate weather so well, they look so good, and of course in London you never see any pieces of raw slate, which you see every day. Anyway, returning to my manic passion for the machine and the lathe, the milling machine, and accuracy and clarity and geometry, which had taken over my ideas completely, I followed this up by the creation of various pieces like this. This is a mixture of bronze and stainless steel. There we are, there's the other great big thing again. This was actually a massive thing, held together by its own weight. It's all suspended chains and great big bearings, stainless steel. It took me about a year to make that thing. And there's another of the same ilk, quite a small piece there, but taking shape very, very clean, very precise, forming them together. There's quite a large piece. Pretty simple and mechanically, but it's how they're fitted together. I no longer use steel. This is a cast aluminium machine. And this is a commission piece in steel. I did for a school in Devon, the Dartington Hall. It actually came from this smaller work here, which is made of aluminium. And the people saw that, and they asked me, well, I would like to make a big piece using the same concept. Soon after that, I was very excited by the idea of sculpture on a very big scale at this time. And the Stuyvesant Foundation decided to commission a number of works for various cities. This piece I made for Southampton, made of steel, and I was really taking, again, the bones or the bones of the idea I'd had. Again, I'd simplified down from a massive of complex chains and odds and ends I'd been using a year or so before to make a very, very simple piece of sculpture. That's the view of the whole of the Dartington Hall piece, which is in a school. Very clear shape, cut out of steel, formed, and very spare. Unfortunately, I haven't got, this is the only slide I could find of this piece. It's actually enormous, and it's in northern New York State. They were forming a sculpture park. It's almost 30 feet high, and you walk through it. It hangs right over the water. But I loved the idea of making something just like a framework amongst the romantic landscape. I just wish I had better slides to show you of that one. There's another view of the Southampton piece. The idea of that piece was that as you walked around, you couldn't actually grasp the whole thing in one, because it's a rather large piece. But it seemed to move around and change with you as you saw the various spaces. But it's obviously based on bird bones and the natural translation of those sort of shapes. And it's back to the gallery again. And by this time, I'd relaxed considerably my urge to make mechanical objects of extreme complexity. In fact, I was going back to a much more simple, formal approach using balance and clear shapes, but they were joined in very simple mechanical ways so that I could keep the balance, the attention. Like the one in the background there is quite a good example too. Here's a piece that nicely lit. It's outside the Haywood Gallery in London. Again, it's a much more gentle piece than a lot of the earlier works. And the sort of lyricism which I'd had in my earlier works was beginning to reemerge again. These are of that period. And we're talking about sort of the 1970, round about then. I love the elegance of the combination of the machine shape, the cut, clear form in the landscape. But my urge for perfection at that time was pretty heavy. I loved the ingenuity of working out a complicated way of making something, so it didn't look complicated. I remember one of my works being bought by Sheffield or one of Leeds or some place, one of the museums in the north. And the director of the museum had been playing with me, took it to bits. He couldn't put it together again because I was sent all the bits back and said, please forgive me. Now, extending the machining and turning, keeping to the idea of separate materials working together, I got very interested in machining masses of wood, rather like I've always liked the way that wood is used on ships and yachts and things like that. The most exciting method of using material. I like the living forms that could be created from wood, and yet the clarity of the machine, the carving by use of mechanical forms. This thing was a massive, great turning, and I had a terrifying time making that thing actually, because in order to turn it, it was a wood turning basically. I clamped together a great mass of heavy ply. And then, of course, I had to make a lathe to turn it with. So I made the lathe, a massive thing. I started it. I thought, well, I can machine it very gently and slowly. And in fact, I found all it did was the wood was so hard, the glues were so impressed in it, that I had to keep increasing the speed. So eventually, I was literally carving what was the equivalent of a massive lorry tire going around at full speed. And the chips of wood coming off were like bullets that were flying to the end of the studio. And I was completely covered in armor from head to foot, just to take my face and arms and eyes. But it was worth it in the end, because sculpture is often the challenge of making something or other. The difficulty of that is the very thing that makes you want to go on, try something else, do something new. And this is the series which led eventually to the ring piece, which is outside the Watcher, which is outside the museum now. I've got very interested in playing with all the forms and shapes I'd done at the Southampton piece, and the piece in America, with the idea of incorporating space and form together. And this is one of the pieces that emerged from that. And this is a much larger sculpture. This is, you can see it here, it's within the Royal Academy in this particular exhibition. But it's had a very, quite a lively life, because here it is again in Dockland, in the open, in the sun, and it now is on the coast of British Columbia on a very rocky cliff, and it's in a wonderful sight with the sea and mountains behind it. So it really pulls in the background. Here you have a couple of chimneys, now you have something. I haven't got a slide of it, but I've seen photographs. Here again, this is a complex piece, but by this time I'm concealing the mechanics. You can't see how it's held together. It just happened. The forms are there standing as they are in here. They seem to be fairly, in this particular piece, quite casually put together, but in fact they're very carefully structured so as to bring out the feel of all the things that are going on in it. This is actually the model, the original model for the ring piece you've seen a few minutes ago. And that's another view of the big Mancini piece, which is being installed later in about a month's time in an absolutely marvelous site in London. Here's another piece again. By this time, I'm really playing down the mechanics, how they're made. I'm not trying to show my dexterity with handling metal, just using the thing in the most natural possible way. And this is a piece I particularly like, actually, of that time, which is in the late 70s. It's in the Fitzwilliam Museum, Cambridge. A little ring piece, tiny ring piece. The bobbin shape, which has emerged in so many of my works, I've never really been able to identify. I know it's a form that means a lot to me. It's a form which is about the head. And I think it goes back to the armor. It's the heart, the head, the living entity.